Hello and welcome to the Waterways Ireland podcast series with me, Turtle Bunbury. In this series, we are exploring the rich history of Ireland's waterways from the beginning of recorded time to the present day. Too often, the history books of Ireland tend to skip straight from the Vikings to the Norman period without pausing to look at the indigenous clans in Ireland. And in fairness, it can be hard to make sense of it all with so much relentless blood and gore during that time. However, there was at least one Irish monarch who stood out from the crowd in that period. His name was Turlough O'Connor, King of Connaught, and it was his mastery of the River Shannon that enabled him to reign as High King of Ireland for 35 years. In our last historical episode, we kind of got to the year 1014 when Brian Boru famously defeated the Vikings at Clontarf, and that was sort of the end of the Viking Age, although, as I say, nothing is quite as simple as that, and believe you me, there's still plenty of Vikings in your parish. Let's advance forward 100 years to the early 12th century, and there's a new kid in town, Turlough O'Connor, or O'Crahur in Irish. Through his mother, he's Brian Boru's great-great-grandson. On his father's side, he descends from a fellow who was king of Connacht back in the 9th century. The O'Connors, as we know them today, were the biggest of the biggies in Connacht for 6 or 7 centuries. Something like 30 kings of Connacht were members of this family, and their descendants would rule the kingdom of Connacht right through until 1475, so hats off to them. Only 2 of those O'Connor kings got the top job. By that I mean that only 2 of them became High King of Ireland. One was our man Turlough, and the other was his son Ruairi, who I'll come on to. Now Turlough, he became King of Connacht in 1106 when he seized the throne at the age of 18, and he's going to go on and reign as High King of all Ireland from about 1121 through until his death 35 years later. So he's 35 years, he's High King, he's King of Connacht for half a century. These are hugely impressive numbers by anyone's standards, let alone during those horrible bloodthirsty days. I'm fascinated by Turlough because, as well as everything else, he was a big player on the Irish waterways and a master of naval strategy. He clearly understood the importance of the rivers within his realm in terms of borderland security and getting his forces to and fro, but he also seems to have seen them as a means to improving everyday life for his subjects. And during his long reign, you will see examples of him changing the layout of the landscapes to, say, improve the water supply that will in turn enable his subjects to irrigate their farms. But it's his fleet that catches my eye, because by 1124, someone does a mass count and they say Turlough O'Connor, he's got 190 ships. That's an awful lot of ships. I don't know how big those vessels were or what they looked like. I guess some were relatively basic, logboats and coracles, curraghs built of wattle and hide. And I imagine others were plank-built wherries, rowing boats, quite big with maybe a sail on it. But some were undoubtedly merchant ships, big galleys capable of sailing to faraway lands. And in his lifetime, Connacht was trading with ports in Scandinavia, Britain, France, right down into Portugal and Spain. And there's also a lot of warships there. And that gives Turlough O'Connor, the King of Connacht, control of large chunks of the Irish coastline, so that at various times during his reign, his fleet is basically ruling the waves from Cork Harbour all the way up to Tory Island off Donegal. Some of those ships are on the Shannon, helping him control the river, giving him access into Lough Derg, And that's where his feet is always causing a certain amount of heartburn to the area. But he's also bringing them up to the surrounding lands and all the islands, all the way up to Athlone and into Loch Ree and Loch Lung, as we'll see. He's got ships all over those lakes. Controlling the waterways was so important because Turlough was to spend most of his reign at war with the kings of Munster and Ulster and Meath and so on. So he kind of lifts his strategy from the Viking playbook, but he understands that dominating the rivers and lakes is a seriously good idea when it comes to waging war. An early example of his superb usage of the waterways came in 1118 when he sent his ships onto the Shannon, right into the heart of the O'Brien kingdom of Thomond. And so we read in the annals of the Four Masters that Turlough O'Connor, at the head of a great army, marched to the palace of King Corra and hurled it, both stones and timber, into the Shannon. Just like that. That is Brian Boru's great fortress at King Corra. Destroyed, hurled into the Shannon. Munster did not forgive Connacht for that slight for a very, well, there's probably somebody out there who's still smarting about it. Turlough O'Connor is also no stranger on the Erne. He sends a force up there in 1111 to trash his enemies. And his army is back up there a decade later, 1122, ravaging the shores of Loch Erne. I'm guessing they got there by sea, maybe sailed in from Ballyshannon, but maybe they came up the Shannon to, I don't know, Belturbet perhaps, and then marched overland. I don't know, maybe somebody out there knows, I'd love to know. In 1121, Turlough is on the River Shannon, in no less a spot than Athlone. And he's there for a sort of summit meeting with his nemesis, Donal MacLachlan, one of the kings from the north who was claiming to be High King at this time. And they met at Athlone and they both promised not to attack each other ever again, with their fingers crossed behind their backs. But then Donal actually unexpectedly died, which is when Turlough seized the opportunity to press his claim to become High King of Ireland. 8 years later, in 1129, Turlough goes back to Athlone, where he takes advantage of a long, hot drought of a summer to send his men onto the Shannon to build a new bridge across the river. And he also builds some sort of castle there of wood. I'd imagine it was probably an improvement of a pre-existing fortification, because Athlone had been a brilliant strategic location for a very long time. It's one of the few places where the Shannon could be crossed, and people back in the Bronze Age would have been aware of that. And as such, there had been a fortress of some form or another at Athlone since time began. I seem to recall Brian Boru went up to Athlone a couple of times. The river was impassable south of Athlone at this point. And the next crossing was way down at Clonmacnoise. And then north of Athlone, it was Loch Ree. The point being that if you own the castle here, and you know, by extension the bridge, well, then you control the ford. Not only that, but you also control the river. And you've got to think of the castle as the centre of a sort of crossroads with a road on the Criss and a river on the Cross. And if you've got a castle slap bang in the centre of that, well, then you're absolutely the boss of it all. Now, keeping a castle is one thing, but keeping the bridge beside it operational is a trickier proposition, as Turlough found with the bridge he built at Athlone beside his castle. It was only about 100 metres south of the current Shannon Bridge, actually in the heart of the town, 330 feet if you prefer, but very close. Bridges as a concept are old as human hands, and as I say, they've had bridges of one form or another across the Shannon at Athlone since the beginning. But before the advent of steel and concrete and asphalt, bridges were made of wood, and as such, they didn't tend to last very long. Turlough's bridge was made of wood. So it wasn't that hard for Mercu O'Muel Shochlin, the King of Meath, to burn it down, which he did in 1133. Now, Mercu O'Muel Shochlin, King of Meath, was Turlough's father-in-law. So if you think you've got a tricky father-in-law, try that. Turlough and Mercu had a major fallout in the 1130s, and the fact that they both had fleets meant it was a pretty big nautical sort of a war. The annals detail some of it. Merku's fleet is actually on both the Shannon and Lough Ree in 1136, for instance, so you can imagine there's a lot of skirmishes between his ships and the O'Connor ships during this time. And then 1137, according to the annals, all the province of Connacht was laid waste from, well, basically from Bundoran to the Shannon. All of Connacht laid waste. So, you know, that's not great. Dark times. Anyways, the two fellas kind of patched things up and they actually reunited at Athlone in 1140 to admire a brand new bridge that Turlough had whacked across the river. And Turlough then used that bridge to send his army thundering across into his father-in-law's kingdom of Meath, into the country through which the Royal Canal now flows. And before long, he had taken control over a large part of both Meath and Leinster. So that's the sort of power a bridge could give you in those days. In fact, he built another bridge across the Shannon at Aharochta, that's near Shannon Harbour. But bridges are nothing compared to what Turlough O'Connor did with the rivers Suck and Hind. The Suck is, well, it's the main tributary of the Shannon, and it forms a large stretch of the Galway-Roscommon county border, flows into the Shannon just south of the village of Shannon Bridge. North of that, we have the River Hind, a small river that starts some way south of Roscommon town, not far from Athleague, and then flows east for about 12 kilometres before it empties into Lough Ree at Cruet Bay near Port Runny. Two fine rivers. But the way they look today, it wasn't always like that. Not at all. In 1139, High King Turlough kick-started a massive engineering scheme that involved both the Suck and the Hind, and he completely changed the lay of the land. This is what the annals of Tiernach had to say. The Suck River was dug by Turlough O'Connor so that it came into the marsh to the south of the plains and the marsh of Ay, making large lakes of them. And it went into the river of the Hind and into Lough Ree, and there was a muster of Connacht men doing that work. In other words, he's got his men digging a whole new waterway of sorts through what would then have been kind of deep, deep forests, big old oaks and crab trees and blackthorn and hazel. It's all set on limestone rock, but somehow these 12th century navvies create what's called a tochilt, meaning a dig. They dug, or somehow excavated, what you might call a linear trench about 2 kilometres in length, by which they redirected and reformed the two rivers into a sort of new border to this part of his kingdom. A broad, marshy plain with new or improved fording junctions at Athleague and present-day Ballinasloe that he controls and which he now fortifies. And hand-in-hand with all of this, he builds 5 new fortifications across this region, including the one at Athlone, and another on Cranogue in what is now Ardachillan Loch in County Roscommon. So it's like he's put a moat along this part of his territory, a massive floodplain of a moat, a barrier that protects his subjects from his local O'Kelly enemies in Tirmoigne and Emoigne to the south and east, as well as his omnipresent rivals in Munster, the O'Briens, for instance. These fords and forts and the new floodplain are of pivotal use when he's trying to get things in or out of his kingdom, like, say, people or armies or livestock. Cattle raids were all the rage at that time. Records state that Turlough O'Connor orchestrated at least 27 cattle raids during his time as High King. And there's an ancient road that came off the Slie Moor at Ballinasloe, and it connects with the Slie Ossal at Tulsk. And this ancient road must have had a lot of raided cattle hooves on its back in those times. It also looks like he had a fleet of ships up there on Loch Long on the present-day Roscommon-Galway border near Dunarmon Castle. Again, these may have been quite small, logboats and coracles and curraghs and wherries and so on, but they were capable of going up and down the Suck during high water periods, or at least they were, until 1146 when Tiernan O'Rourke, the one-eyed king of Breffni, led what the annals call a predatory excursion to Loch Long, and he burned four of those ships anyway. Quite a lot of townland boundaries in that area seem to have been created at this time also, which makes sense. It's almost impossible to see what Turlough was up to in the present day, because Victorian engineers then went and redug those rivers and stuck in new drainage schemes and so on, especially when they were trying to convert the River Hind into a canal to connect Roscommon to the Royal Canal. Luckily, that's why we have historians to try and make sense of all this. And if you are interested in the story, I direct you to the research of Daniel Curley and Martin Timoney and their study of the River Suck Hind Tokhilt. There you have it, a massive bit of early medieval engineering in the landscape of Connacht. And I think it underlines how between all the wars of this period, there are actually long periods of peace, months, seasons, sometimes even years, in which everyone lives relatively peaceably, and nothing important happens because it's only the war bits that people bother writing about. There were useful and clever things happening along the way too, like diverting rivers or building weirs. Plenty of weirs were built during this era also in order to help people catch fish and salmon and trout and eel, for instance. So Turlough O'Connor, he's building bridges and he's building castles and he's creating big rivery borders, and over on the west coast he develops the harbour at Galway too. All of this is part of his project to control access in and out of his ever-expanding home territory, the Kingdom of Connacht. He also wants his kingdom to become a new centre of Christianity. Religion was a big part of Turlough's life, and I don't think it's overstating things to say he saw himself as one of the great Christian monarchs on a par with Jerusalem, which was also a Christian kingdom at this time. Turlough's kingdom included Clonmacnoise, arguably the most famous holy place on the Shannon. That's where Turlough O'Connor would one day be buried. It's also where his dad died, his father, Ruaidhrí O'Connor, another king of Connacht who had been blinded by the O'Flahertys in his prime. Clonmacnoise was very much on Turlough's radar. In 1115, for example, when his fleet defeated some more enemies, he gave thanks to God by bestowing a drinking horn inlaid with gold and a golden cup and a patina for a chalice upon the monastery of Clonmacnoise. In 1124, he funded the completion of the Round Tower at Clonmacnoise. Some say he had his own mint at Clonmacnoise, but I don't know if there's any evidence for that other than wishful thinking. It's possible that he was minting for religious donations, I suppose. As well as Clonmacnoise, he began to home in on turning Tuam into his religious centre. In 1123, quite early on in his reign, Turlough got hold of a piece of what was said to be a relic of the true cross, the supposed cross on which Jesus Christ died, which had come to Ireland to do a sort of processional tour. He enshrined that relic at Roscommon and commissioned the famous Cross of Cong to hold it. And then he built a new cathedral in Tuam to hold the cross. And he commissioned at least three stone-high crosses. And it's all part of a wild dream to build Tuam up into a sort of new Jerusalem, which I'm not going to go into here, but it's a fabulous story and I'm working on it in conjunction with the historian Michael Brabazon. Nonetheless, away from the church, war was kind of the dominant thing during Turlough's reign. His rival kings try to get the edge on him every now and then. In 1145, the O'Briens of Munster team up with a fleet of Ostmen, Viking descendants, to try and break Turlough's grip on the Shannon. But Turlough strikes first. He sinks the entire O'Brien fleet at the mouth of the Shannon, and that's the end of that plan. So again, we see the importance of the waterways at a potentially pivotal moment in Irish history. Then, 1146, as I mentioned, Tiernan O'Rourke, the one-eyed king of Breffni, burns some of Turlough's ships on Loch Lung. Tiernan was also one of the guys who'd burned Athlone Castle down in 1133, so Turlough is all out to nail this guy. And he gets his sort of retribution in the year 1152. Turlough makes pals with Murhurtuck MacLauchlan, the King of Alloch. In March 1152, Murhurtuck hosts a two-part synod, a major get-together of all the clerical and royal and administrative bigwigs of 12th century Ireland. The first part takes place in Kells, the second a few days later at Mellifont, both places being sort of on tributaries of the River Boyne. And the impact of this double synod is to entirely reorganise Ireland's diocesan structure, where all the churches and parishes and so on. Turlough's dream of making Tuam a religious hub gets the seal of approval, and Tuam is elevated into an archbishopric alongside Dublin. So this is the sort of genesis of his friendship with Murhurtuck MacLauchlan, the King of Alloch. Now, a few months after that, Turlough and Murhurtuck meet up at Beleek on the River Erne, and they decide to team up for a little military foray. And they get Dermot McMurrough. He's the brash young King of Leinster. He comes in on their side too. And off they go to annihilate Tiernan O'Rourke, the one-eyed King of Breffni. And in fact, they take out the King of Meath too. That's his ally. So that's a huge success. But, you know, it is war, 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 I know. But there are also many, many aspects of Turlough's life that I haven't touched on. But he clearly did an awful lot during the 5 decades that he reigned as King of Connacht before his death in the summer of 1156. In their obituaries to him, the annals describe him as the head of the prosperity and wealth of the world, and noted that his considerable riches included 100 ounces of gold. That's quite a lot of bags of sugar weight in gold, isn't it? And 60 marks of refined silver. So, you know, a lot of money there. He was buried beside St. Kieran's altar in Clonmacnoise, where, as I say, many members of his bloodline already lay. He had something like 5 wives and 23 sons. He's kind of like Sheikh Turlough in that regard. Anyway, you can imagine there had been a certain amount of jostling to succeed him. The winner was, in time, his youngest son, Ruairi O'Connor, who would become King of Connacht and who would indeed one day become the last High King of Ireland. Straight off the bat, Ruairi recognises the importance of the waterways. In the winter after he succeeds his father, he positions his fleet on the Shannon in anticipation of a major showdown with the Northern O'Neills. It didn't actually happen, but again, there's the waterways. Now, I mentioned Dermot McMurrough, King of Leinster, a while ago. He was the king who teamed up with Turlough in 1152. And it was during that campaign that Dermot famously abducted the wife of the one-eyed King Tiernan O'Rourke of Breffni. Well, at least some say he abducted her, but others say she went willingly. Her name was Dervagilla, Dervla, sometimes she's called. And she's a sort of Helen of Troy in Irish history because almost 20 years later, that event, that abduction, that elopement, call it what you will, that would be the catalyst for the next major event in Irish history, an event that is going to have a massive impact on Ireland's waterways. I refer, of course, to the coming of the Normans, and we'll talk about them next time. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Waterways Through Time. You'll find more episodes on waterwaysireland.org or on Alexa, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll find my archive of historical stories, mostly Irish, at turtlebunbury.com. My sincere thanks to series producer Ali Bunbury and technical producer Mary Burke.